Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, women's work as scientists, firefighters, farmers, and fishermen, a new collection of photographs. But first, our guest asks a rather startling question in the early pages of his book. Am I 52 years old, or have I just been born? That sensation of being new to the world comes from a long-awaited gender transition from Polly to Carl that happened as our culture was asking what it means to be a man. P. Carl writes, "Transitioning for a time is like pushing Polly off the top of a mountain. I have to burn down the house of Polly so that Carl can come out." P. Carl is an artist in residence at Emerson College and the author of Becoming a Man, The Story of a Transition. He joins us this morning from Boston. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
And you prefer Carl, right?
Yeah, that's great. Yep.
Okay. You know, that is a fierce image that you've drawn for us, that idea of having to burn Polly's house down so that Carl can, in essence, rise from the ashes. I wonder at what point in your transition you thought that Polly had to be vanquished in that way.
Well, I think one of the things about the book is that I write it very much in the present tense, so that you as the reader and I are almost in it together. And I think early on in the transition, in terms of the real physical transition, I saw a lot of people mourning Polly's loss. And of course, as you're trying to come into yourself and you're experiencing not so much people's excitement for where you're headed, but for what you've left behind, I think the early stages were a sense of needing to get away from what I left behind. And that's, I think, not an uncommon part of going through a transition.
The people that were mourning Polly's loss were your parents, right? Probably your other family members, your wife. What were they saying to you about the loss of Polly?
Well, I think that in some ways they didn't know always what to say. Obviously, if you've been a daughter your entire life, how does a mother let go of a daughter? I don't think maybe that would be possible for her. So that's a part of the transition that you have to come to accept. I think the bigger piece of it is what did it mean for my marriage to my wife Lynette, as we'd been together for 20 years at that point. So the real question I think for her was, who's this new person, and can I go from living as a lesbian for 40 years to in this other kind of relationship?
I have to say, I've been very curious about Lynette, and I was almost wishing that Lynette would join the interview.
Yes,
you've heard that before, I'm sure.
Yes, I have, exactly. Yeah.
Since we're talking about your marriage, there's a moment in the couple's therapy session where you're deep into the transition. Lynette is wrestling with what this is going to mean, and together you two are trying to deal with where the marriage goes from here. And the therapist asks your wife, "Polly has left and she's not coming back. How do you feel about that?" It is a profound question, do you think? Do you think you and Lynette have figured that out yet, even now?
It was really profound in the moment for somebody to say it so outright. I think in some ways I wanted to protest that I'm still me in some ways, and yet I'm not me, and what parts are you bringing forward and what parts have you left behind? And I think what the therapist at the time was saying was that for Lynette, she had to let go of this person, both physically and emotionally in many ways, that was no longer there. And I think the moment was pretty stunning to both of us, and The process, as I say in the book, I didn't ever feel I was leaving the marriage. I felt I was appearing in it for the first time. And I think as the transition went on and as I became me and embodied, and Lynette went through her own process of figuring out her relationship to her own embodiment and to me, I think we've been very fortunate because we've found a really really wonderful space and a wonderful marriage after a couple of very, very difficult years.
Yeah, fortunate, but you both also clearly recommitted, and you did some very hard work to make this work. Yeah. I mean, there's been some luck, but there's been some hard work too, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that, and you see it in the book, and I write a letter in the book to Lynette, and I think you can feel in the book how much we love each other and how much we really want to make it work.
Absolutely.
Even in the worst moments. Yeah. And I think that the question in the book, one of the questions in the book is, can we get to a place beyond gender in this particular, scenario of love? And like I said, fortunately, the answer was yes, after a lot of hard work.
You know, I think this goes to what we're talking about, because one of the things I wondered about how your relationship to your family would change and how your relationship with your wife would change. I mean, there are some essential things about you that would not change as your body changed, right? Your innate kindness, innate mm-hmm. compassion, the principles that you hold high as to what it means to be human. I mean, that wasn't going to change about you, and yet you use this word doubling through the memoir as you describe this experience of knowing that you were meant to be male even though you were female. But I thought of this as doubling from the looking in from the outside, but weren't there some things about you that just simply were not going to change, that would be recognizable no matter what your body looked like? You can see I'm trying to figure this out. What would you
yes.
say?
I mean, yes, I think for me, there's a core shaping to my being that comes from multiple experiences. And those things have not changed. My commitment to, I have a lifelong commitment to equality and justice and activism. That has not changed in any way. I've learned more along the way through this transition about those things. And so the core sense of striving, and I think you feel it in the book, to want to be a good, not just a good man, but a good person in the world, and knowing that sometimes I fail miserably at that and sometimes I succeed. I think the notion of doubling in the book is really about the ways in which we perform different versions of ourselves in different kinds of contexts, and that it's something that I think anybody who's lived in the body of a woman has to know, as a woman who was in positions of, when I was living as a woman, as in positions of power, I there were completely different rules for how I could behave and how men in power could behave. And I wasn't very good at learning those rules, but most people learn them if they want, most women learn them if they want to stay in any kind of position of power. And you really, I really got a deep sense of that as I was transitioning, watching the way in which women were contort themselves in scenarios, and then the way that men have much more freedom. They argue with each other, they hash it out, they say mean things to each other, and then they go have a beer. And the woman who loses her temper is an angry woman. And so, you probably have an ounce of familiarity with that.
No. I was so glad you wrote about that. I mean, I don't think there's a woman alive who doesn't make split-second, sometimes completely subconscious calculations about what you've just talked about. I can be this way, I can be that way. What's the room, what kind of a message is the room telling me right now? And it is extremely rare to be able to see that from both sides of the gender perspective, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was one of the real things I wanted to convey in the book, and to be able to have a fresh conversation about white masculinity in this culture, because one of the things that I learn in coming to live as a man is the privileges that come with it are not something anyone could know, because if you've never not had them, you would not know that you had them. And so when I walked into these spaces and was treated just in a completely different fashion, it was really quite stunning. And I wanted to write about that because in some ways it made me angrier than I had been being treated as a woman. I'm like, oh my God, the double standards are so, and the hypocrisy for me was really so apparent. And I think there are, I've heard from a lot of men who've read the book or read the piece that was in the New York Times. And I think a lot of white men want to have this conversation openly and honestly. And I think that's an important piece of the book.
Yeah, you may be the perfect person to have that conversation with, right? Because you move through some of these spaces now. I think of you in some ways like you're a bit undercover. I mean, you know exactly what it is like to be a woman in some in these very complicated places with all these cross currents going on. So you listen and you observe and you participate in a way that I'm never going to be able to. And then you bring that back and you tell us what you hear.
Yeah, I'm mostly worried that my spy personality is going to be outed because of the book. And people are going to, I bought new glasses just in case.
Did you?
Yeah, really, I did. But I think that's exactly what I've been doing. I spend a lot of time observing. I will sometimes hear, well, why don't you interject and break up the conversation? And mostly because I think my work is to write about it, to observe it, to try to piece it together, and to try to make some kind of sense of these doubling lives that men have, where they're talking about inclusion and equity and justice and feminism and all of these nice things, and maybe they're making dinner, and then I'm at the bar sitting next to them, and the things that are coming out of their mouth sound quite different. I feel like this capacity to see that is important to the culture right now.
We're having a conversation, if you've just joined in, with P. Carl, the author of a new memoir called Becoming a Man, The Story of a Transition. He's a distinguished artist in residence at Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts, and joining us this morning from Boston. If you'd like to join the conversation on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, by phone, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Let's come back to what you said about you are clearly wrestling with what it means to be a good man in the culture that we're in today. First, tell me a little bit about how you would define what it means to be good in a definition of masculinity today. I don't know that we're all agreed on that.
Yes, I think that's right. I think there's quite a significant schism there. I think that this is true, about masculinity, and I think it's about white masculinity in particular, is I think part of it is not so much to have to feel that we can know what it is to be in another person's body, but I think it really is about listening. It really is about the one thing I find is the minute you say the word white men, the level of defensiveness is so intense that the conversation ends right there. And a white man will say, well, don't talk about all white men. But we say women all the time. We say people of color all the time. I'm grouped in a group of people, LGBTQ. I mean, there's like 20 letters that I'm grouped with. So we're always grouping people. But white men have been the origin story of this country. And this is the moment of letting go of that origin story and seeing the way in which they, too, live as a subject position in the culture.
Okay,
that is scrutinized.
So I hear you on that. So then I guess I want to know how you have decided that this is, with all of the conflicting interests and, as I said, cross currents that are going on with this, I'm curious about how you've decided what this good man is.
Well, for me, what it's become is really becoming more informed about the way in which white masculinity has become what it is historically, mm-hmm. To understand that our current political nightmare is not something that comes out of the blue. It's a manifestation of a very long history in this country. So in some ways, I've become a student of the history of white masculinity, of how power functions in white and bodies. I'm teaching a course at Princeton right now called Ruled by Conviction, Confronting Narratives of White Masculinity. And, of course, you know, we've been reading texts by white men for a long time, but what if we came and looked at them in a totally different way? And so this is, of my projects, one of them.
Relin says on Twitter, I want to support parents and partners who are mourning the loss of a loved one who's transitioning, but I'm also frustrated that they're mourning their apparent loss rather than celebrating that their loved one can now live who they have always been. Does that make sense to you, Carl?
Yeah, I mean, it's so tricky. The one thing about being a trans person that you, and I say this in the book, is early on, I think people felt like a victim of my transition, that I had taken something away, and that I was somehow cavalierly, you know, making some choice about my body. And I think it's really, there has to be a way of having both things. And it may be, I'm now able to mourn or think about my history with Lynette. We can do that together now. 3-4 years ago, I couldn't do that as easily. And sometimes it's just allowing the process of letting somebody become themselves, supporting them, and finding places that you can mourn that may not involve them for a time.
You know, I'm thinking about how to ask this, but what you just said made me think about parents who take pride in, you know, having given birth to, having created a human form that looks, you know, that carries the legacy of a generation, right? Carries the legacy of a family. I mean, you know, parents who really take pride in the athletic prowess of a child or mm-hmm. in the blue eyes that have come down through, you know, a family. In some ways, I guess I can understand a family, a parents having to really adjust to this idea that this familiar form that they've loved and seen for 50 years, in your case, is going to change, is going to vanish in some ways. Does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, complete sense. And I think one of the things that's happened as the book has come out and I've been on a book tour, I can't tell you the number of parents who come to hear and ask questions.
That's good.
And they either are parents or they're aunts and uncles of, you know, people who have a brother or sister who has a son transitioning or a daughter transitioning. And I think that question is, I can't inhabit somebody else's grief around that. I can only say from my own perspective that the greatest gift you can give anyone is the space to become who they are. And I, you know, I talk about in the book this incredible, my incredible cousins and their child who is, you know, born in the body of a boy and is living out every single girl fantasy you could possibly imagine. And I don't know where he will land on the spectrum. I have no idea what the outcome will be. But what when people ask me who I admire, I always say, oh, I admire them because they're just giving him all the space he needs, the sewing machine and the fabric and the glitter and whatever else he needs to become and feel like he's embodied. So that seems like the most important thing.
Call from Sean in Duluth. Hi, Sean. It sounds like you're listening to this with some recognition. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. I can relate to a lot of what I'm hearing right now on the show. I'm up in Duluth, and I'm the co-founder of a group up there called Trans Plus. And we are really the only group in the area, you know, north of the Twin Cities, who focus solely on connecting and supporting trans and gender nonconforming people. And I'm just thinking about my own transition, too. Like, early on, I transitioned a little bit later on in life when I was 27, and I'm 33 now. And so a lot of the questions that I had at the beginning of my transition were around, what kind of a man do I want to be? What kind of a man in my community? What kind of husband in the future, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm married now. And what kind of a father? And And it was really around the time of Me Too and thinking about toxic masculinity. And I had a lot of examples of what not to do and not as many examples of men, you know, and masculine people that I could look to and really say, that's how I want to be. And so just taking so much stock in, you know, the characteristics that I love about myself, my kindness, my generosity, and then how do I actually let those things come out in my masculinity for other men, you know, to see and hopefully to learn from that as well.
So, Sean, when you heard Carl and I talking at the beginning about this phrase that he used of being, you know, kind of born anew, that resonated with you. I mean, you had choices about this reentry into the world and how you were going to do that. Most of us, you know, make some of those choices, but not, I think, to the degree that you and Carl have.
Right. And I think about the socialization piece for me, you know, growing up for 27 years of my life, being seen as a female and, you know, thinking of myself as that way as well. It's really interesting what you learn and how you learn to be a woman in society, how women and girls protect each other and look out for each other. And then, you know, once I started transitioning, it was like, oh, I'm out here on my own now being this man. And how do I do that? What does that look like for me?
What do you hear in that, Carl, and what Sean's saying?
I mean, I think it's I relate to that, particularly somebody who is living with another woman and living primarily around more women probably than men, and transitioning and knowing that that particularly in the Me Too movement, a lot of women don't want to be around men, period. I have one good female friend who says, you're the only man I hang out with. And so I think you feel a sense of what the implications are of taking on masculinity. I write in the book about, you know, if I'm in a park by myself and a woman comes into the park, that you feel the fear that she feels in my presence, for example. And those are things that come with being a man and a white man in this culture. And so you have to contend with both, you know, the great euphoria of being you and then all of the complicated things that come with that.
P. Carl is with us, if you've just joined the show, talking to us this morning about his memoir about living in the world for 50 years as a woman and making the decision to transition to a man in the midst of a lot of discussion and cultural wrestling with what it means to be a man in the midst of the Me Too movement and all of the questions that that brought with it. The memoir is called Becoming a Man, The Story of a Transition. I want to, because you mentioned this child of your cousin's who, and again, you say you don't know where this will go. I'm curious about when you started to actually find language for what you felt. I mean, is that something that you understand really innately from a very, very young age, but it takes a while to develop how you will describe this to yourself first?
I mean, yeah, and of course, I'm of a generation where these were not conversations in any way, shape, or form. In you know, my childhood and most of my life. But I think the thing I say is that I had the most language for it probably starting at age four. I knew exactly where my reflections were, who I was looking at, where I wanted to, you know, what team I wanted to play on, what things I wanted to play with, and I knew where I felt at home, and what the culture does because of this binary that doesn't quite fit everyone, slowly takes that away, and then there's a period of time where you have to figure out how to get your way back to that. And I talk about in the book, I mean, there are a number of times when I think I knew that about myself, but I didn't really have any language. And then I think there was something about the culture starting to provide language. And I say, you know, one of the things that started it was simply my college covering gender reassignment surgery as part of our health insurance. And so that I could afford to, you know, make my body feel more like me. And so it's a lot of things that I think came together at the right time for me to, you know, take the risk to live as myself for however long I'll be here.
I don't want to miss what you said, though, there at the beginning, where you said, you know, you understood this at four, but in a childhood where that slowly gets taken away, you mean the gender socialization that just kind of naturally goes on because that's what the culture and what parenting kind of determines, right? Bit by bit, you are segmented into what your gender appears to be on the outside. Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are probably pockets where that's changing some, but certainly in the era that I was born, and I talk about this, I mean, I had my first panic attack at my first girl slumber party. You know, like, what was I doing there? Everybody's putting on makeup, and I had no connection to any of what was articulated in our culture as girlhood or femininity or and so I think that the sense of my body needing to be confined, the insistence that I wear a dress to my job as a teller in a bank so I could put myself through college, and the horror of that for me. And always knowing those things were wrong, but also being it was either that or be unemployed. I think this is but the knowing, I think for some people, the knowing is quite early.
Yeah. I want to share this these couple of sentences with listeners here. You write, "What I know is that this transition wasn't something I knew I wanted. It wasn't something I chose. It was a longing and a desire so deeply embedded in my body that I could barely access it." Carl, one of the things that I wondered about as I read the memoir was what people did, you know, and you're saying you're kind of at the edge of the curve here. What did people do for centuries who had this kind of knowledge and never could, you know, express it or do the things that you've done? Well, yeah, have you ever thought about that?
I mean, I do think about that. And, you know, certainly I've read some of that. I think people, there are moments in history where people, you know, pave a way through certain, in some parts of the culture where women would wear men's clothes, for example. Or, I think I can imagine, because I almost lived a whole life without being embodied, and it wasn't by any means completely empty. Many good things were a part of it, the thing I can't imagine is what's happened in the time of the transition. Is I go places and I feel at ease, and when you have spent an entire life never walking into a restaurant, a shopping mall, any single place, and felt at ease, and then you begin to have the opposite experience of like, oh, I'm just walking along here. I don't feel, I don't belong. And that that's life-saving for a person. So you understand why there's such a high rate of suicide for trans people. I think you understand why, it's so incredibly difficult. And yet it is in so many ways, it's not a choice that. And who? Why would I have disrupted my life at 50 to the degree that I did unless I felt like I couldn't go on otherwise?
Yeah, this is the misunderstanding, probably, that this is just something that it's a choice, and that there is a, I think you used this word before, some kind of a cavalierness to the decision to make this choice. This memoir, I think, gives us a lot of depth and understanding that it is nothing like that.
Yeah, it's there's a scene where I'm talking to my therapist because everybody seems so upset about the loss of Polly, and I can't understand why. And I said, you know, when I made the choice to have top surgery, people kind of rolled with it. And she's like, Carl, did you just say choice to have top? You know, choice is having a BLT or a kale salad for lunch. This isn't. What are you talking about? She's like, you have gone on a path to basically have a life and save a life, and there's nothing remotely choice ridden about it. It's really about an innate drive to be seen and really at, you know, at 51 to finally look in the mirror and go, oh, there I am, you know, I exist.
Yeah, innate drive is a good way to put that. You know, I've been curious about how you feel the very public transition of Caitlyn Jenner, what that has meant to, you know, Americans at large to see this, to have Caitlyn Jenner be quite public about it. She was on the cover of Vanity Fair in a bathing suit, I think. Has it? What's been the effect of that?
The Caitlyn Jenner story was emerging as I was really, you know, in the early stages of the transition, it was a strange experience. One was there was a lot of. A lot of horrible things said from all sorts of different camps. A lot of women saying that a person born with the anatomy of a man can never be a woman, which is completely not true. And so there was that argument happening, and then there was also the sensationalizing of surgeries and bathing suits and like this way in which it becomes so bodily, and I think that's important in one way, and in some ways it's so much more for me about an emotional becoming, and so I don't feel like that coverage felt more like entertainment Hollywood than the real life of what it feels like to be a trans person.
Okay, so I wondered about that, and I was watching an interview that Caitlyn Jenner did with Diane Sawyer about that cover. A Vanity Fair in the bathing suit. But you know what? You can hear in this clip, she's wrestling with a lot of what you've brought up in your memoir. So listen to this.
My feeling on that picture, I know my kids that thought, you know what? It's a little too much. But from my standpoint, I had suffered for 65 years, okay? To have a beautiful shot of my authentic self was important, and the shock value.
You wanted the shock value?
Yes.
Carl, what do you think?
I mean, I think the idea of all kinds of bodies being on the cover of all kinds of magazines there could be nothing better for America than that. So in that regard, and I completely relate to waiting 65 years and then finally being seen, however that would be best for her to be seen. And so I think that all makes sense in terms of the shock value. I think in my particular book, I'm interested in less the shock and more the sense of connection and humanity that, in fact, I'm actually telling you a story about living that happens to include the fact that I'm a transgender person, and that's a big part of it. But I think when you read the book, you see a lot of relationship between politics and culture and family and self that at least I've heard from many people who've read the book, we all struggle with. And I think my goal was less to be shocking and more to be finding a familiar language that would connect us.
I'm glad people are reading the memoir, and I'm really grateful for the time this morning. Thank you very much.
Really a pleasure, Carrie. Thank you so much for having me.
P. Carl's memoir is called Becoming a Man, The Story of a Transition.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.